T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Lawrence Holmes, noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station.
Previously on The Lawrence Holmes Show.
I love the broadcast that NBC Sports Chicago does with Benetti and Stone. And we have both those guys on the show. We have Stone on pretty regularly. Stoney and Benetti were talking about how, even in a season where they've tried to speed the game up, the game hasn't really been sped up.
Look, we know this is a great sport. We believe it's the best sport there is. But we are in the battle of our lives for the entertainment dollar. And entertainment in the game is not watching pitchers take their hat off, wiping their brow, walking around, rubbing up the baseball, taking their glove off, and adjusting whatever it is they have to adjust. That's not entertaining. So let's make some entertainment for the fans by seeing continuous action if we can get it. And I think this is the easiest way to do it.
I agree with you completely. I think it's important to note as well, while we're talking about this, that as of 1978, for people who say, well, you're affecting the game negatively and you're changing the game and all that, the wrong way. In 1978, the average game time was 2:30. We're talking, what, 40 years ago, it was 2:30. Even back to 2005, it was 2:49. So if people say, well, in the TV era, you have all these breaks, it was 2:49 in 2005, the year the Sox won the World Series. And the other thing I'll say to your point about bringing entertainment into the ballgame, it's the reason we can't have garbage like don't swing 3-0. Like, it shouldn't even be an argument. Let people be entertaining. You want to hit a grand slam? Go ahead and hit a grand slam.
Sitting in for the vacationing Lawrence Holmes today are Dan Bernstein and Jason Benetti.
Two white guys doing Lawrence Holmes' show.
Make me a bicycle clown.
And welcome to it. Indeed, you have the Lawrence Holmes Show on Sports Radio 670 The Score. I'm Dan Bernstein, joined by this man, Jason Benetti. Hello, sir.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm good. And you point out via Twitter, and this is true, and this is really kind of cool, and it kind of touched me a little bit. The first former Boers and Bernstein intern to co-host a show with either Boers or Bernstein. That's kind of neat. It's sort of a circle of life thing.
I didn't know I was the first. That's amazing.
You have to be. I mean, who else? Well, I mean, there have been obviously producers who have, but I don't think any intern has. I mean, that's really kind of a cool thing. I like that. I mean, it makes me feel very old, but still kind of awesome.
I recall when and I'm sure somebody with the Sox is going to give me crap for this, but the one bit that I was proud of, that when I interned with you guys, the White Sox had just collected like Carl Everett, and Robbie Alomar had done the whole thing with the spitting and all that. And you came in and Terry, and it was like, well, what can we do with this? And I had contributed nothing. I didn't even know how to use a copier. Like, it took multiple times for me to figure out what a copier was. And I was like, you know, there's that Hedley Lamarr Blazing Saddles bit where he's listing all the different types of people.
Yes.
That are coming to the thing. And I was like, you should play that.
That's
and
right.
It made air.
It was like bushwhackers, muggers, buggers. Yeah. I loved the relish with which he said buggers. it makes that whole thing. Oh. So that was your call.
That was the one thing I ever contributed, including not knowing how to clip things out of the Sun Times and assorted other crap that I didn't do very well. And then sometimes just not showing up because the Metro train was late from Mokina. Like, I was a bad intern, but Look at me now.
Right? Look at now. And you can actually see Jason Benetti on our Twitch stream. It is twitch.tv/Chicago670. The Score, Brian Gerch, is directing. And I should mention that Mike Petriello of MLB.com and StatCast is going to join us at 12:20. We're also going to talk to Mick Mixon, who is the radio voice of the Carolina Panthers. That's coming up at 1:20. Get a little behind the scenes.
Behind enemy lines. That's what I like to call it.
We have Herb Lawrence, the dear boy himself. Herb is on the board today. And this is kind of cool, you know, flying along at this point. Anything happening in the world of the White Sox?
Oh, no. Haven't heard nothing. Just threw my phone in a lake and wasn't listening to the show before this one.
Well, I know. Let's be honest. You are in a position unlike others, and I don't want to make life uncomfortable for you, but I also want to know what you think of the story of the day.
Well, the headline for me is that I've talked to a source within the White Sox who said to me that there are multiple serious candidates. So the stuff about La Russa above everybody else, from what I'm hearing, is not exactly accurate, that there are multiple serious candidates. And so that's where I sit on this, that I think this situation is still being fleshed out as to who the lead candidate is. And I know the way the headline was in the Nightingale piece said otherwise.
Right.
But from what I'm hearing, there are multiple serious candidates. And to put one ahead of the other, it's way early to do that, is what I'm hearing.
That is the issue that I had with Bob Nightingale's reporting from the outset, specifically the framing of this as his job to turn down, or that he is the number one candidate, something other than sequentially. That was the issue that I had specifically with the way it was reported, because he doesn't know. And Rick Hahn may not know who his absolute number one candidate is right now. And the reassurances that I got in talking to people around the team, that it's Rick's hire. And when you talk to people close to Jerry, Jerry Reinsdorf believes in the hierarchy. And he believes in allowing guys like Rick Hahn and Arturis Karnišovas to hire their guy. And I guess I should learn my lesson from my self-imposed Jim Boylan torture, that I totally did it to myself. And I just like, why haven't they fired him yet? There's a new guy, and there's a new brain trust and a new VP and a new GM. Why haven't they fired him? They took their time. They wanted to consider the possibility. The Jim Boylan, who had been given an extension, who was well-liked by ownership, and ultimately they're like, no, we're gonna bounce this dope as soon as we can get him out of the meeting. And that it's just not the way Jerry Reinsdorf does business to push down a candidate or to tell a GM whom to hire. He doesn't believe in that. And that is, I was reassured and heartened to understand that. However, as you know personally, he will say, I want to interview this person myself, and say, this is your first choice. Okay, let me sit in a room with this person, because as I remember it, you have been there when the ceremonial cigar is kindled.
And I didn't smoke it because I don't smoke, and probably nearly lost the job. So there's somebody kicking around on their couch in AAA going, well, if he was just a little meaner about the cigar, maybe I could have had the job. But I think the one thing that's important, and I do believe it, what strikes me about the way the reaction has gone to that name being out there, is that people heard Rick Hahn's press conference and assumed a type of person and a type of leader that the category that Tony La Russa is in wouldn't specifically fit. But you know, I heard what you were saying about, like, what would Tim Anderson think about certain people and all of this stuff. That thought that you had registered in my mind the final week of the 2020 regular season, when the whole thing with Wilson Contreras happened and the bat flip. And as we were watching it, we watched, Stoney and I did, and you all at home, Tim and Contreras talking at second base. The next day, Rick Hahn was on this station, and he said, if you don't like it, get him out. And so there's a level of understanding from the general manager's chair of what you're talking about with change the game,
mm-hmm.
and of the belief of how that fund should be promulgated across baseball from the White Sox as hub of that. And so I believe that anybody that gets chosen would have to have convinced everybody, Rick Hahn, Kenny Williams, Jerry Reinsdorf, that that is part of what that person's going to do. That's my feeling based on Rick immediately coming out and saying what he said after the Contreras stuff.
Part of the fun of this White Sox team for me was the swagger of how we saw this coming together. And it's not just the way it's marketed, but that matters too. It matters too that that aspect of the organization, that arm of the organization that reaches out to the fan, it is the forward-facing presentation to the fan. They've thought long and hard about this. They have really worked hard at imaging this team in that way. And it's no small thing. The Tim Anderson bat flip was described to me, and whether we knew it or not at the time, the Tim Anderson bat flip against Kansas City was a cultural inflection point. There was an energy there that they didn't want to let go. And all they've done is help propagate some of that energy in these supremely confident young men. And watching the way that the smiles of Eloy Jimenez and the hi mom and Luis Robert being who he is, the way they move, the way they interact, it's so joyful and it's so real and it's so expressive that it would really just bug me and bum me out as a fan if they decided to bring in a countervailing force that could in any way wind that back, let alone before we bring in the awful thoughts on Colin Kaepernick and everything else about what was said in 2016 and reiterated on the radio in 2020, that even notwithstanding, I want more. And I want someone who is going to meet this and make this a part of not just who they are, but why they're good.
Yeah, I agree. And my partner, you know, you've known Stoney for years and years and years. Stoney tries to keep as ministerial as possible and as objective as possible and away from the emotional tug of rooting for a guy, because that is his personality. He is a great friend, but that's the way he is in mm-hmm. the booth. After the Giolito no-hitter, he said to me as we were on the elevator going downstairs to go into our cars separately, he said, this team and this moment has made me want to go down this elevator and run onto the field and give Lucas a high five.
Wow.
And for me, that's a powerful thing from a guy who has tried to be capital O objective over the course of his time and to great results, great success, great trust from the audience. But to have him have that visceral reaction to that moment, it's not just Lucas, and it's not just James McCann, and it's not just a catch by Adam Engel. It's the whole atmosphere around a team sort of lifting a cloud of objectivity. That's not really a cloud, but I describe it as clouds because they're parting. And put something in somebody. And if it's happening to him, it's happening to people watching and loving this team too. That was a big moment that night for me to know what this team can do to bring people happiness. And I think you and I both feel this way, that when we hear that baseball has healing properties and all of that, we say, can we just deal with the virus and like get kids back in school?
That'd be nice.
Like that's how I feel about that. And I think you do too. But to me, there was a level of emotional contact that came from this team this year that I want to see continue. So whatever it is that makes that continue, I feel very strongly that this is one of those sort of magnetic forces that can really do some great things to make people happy.
I thought you were going to go in a little different direction when you invoked Stoney's name, because I also think that he's an example of something that baseball should see more of. And that is a former player 70 years old or more getting it in that way and understanding where baseball is heading and understanding that just because back in my day he would have gotten a fastball in the ribs, he'd be staring at the sky. That wasn't okay. I guess this is how they play it now. He's not doing that. And sometimes we lose sight of celebrating the fact that even if in his heart of hearts he knows that there used to be a different way this game was played by the rough, tough guys who played it, it's not like that anymore. And it's other cultures play the game differently. And if you go to watch a game in Venezuela or in the Dominican Republic or elsewhere or in Puerto Rico, that there's a way that they play. I fell in love with the Puerto Rican World Baseball Classic team. There is that Lindor, the Baez, the joie de vivre that comes along with it. And it's not just okay. It's not just tolerated. It's better. It's great. And the fact that you know, it's one thing for me to do it and for me to understand it. It's another thing for a former player and Cy Young winner and national broadcaster and someone of his standing to have that a part of his current baseball aesthetic. I just think it's really cool.
Well, it's the phrase dancing like nobody's there is a phrase that strikes me when I think about Puerto Rico or Korea or whatever it might be. And I think that was sort of slightly the cool thing about this season of Major League Baseball, which is very difficult in a lot of ways. But some of these guys had that feeling that they had to dance like nobody was there and they weren't being judged by a crowd immediately. And there was a little bit more flair, but there's a freedom in and having done a bunch of games from South Korea from my home, there's a freedom in even the swings, right? Somebody will corkscrew themselves out of the batter's box and not think anything of it. And they'll smile at the pitcher. And there's sort of like a generosity in spirit that comes with that rather than a don't do this because we said so. And to close the conversation, and Herb's looking at his watch, which I think in talk radio means, hey, go to the break. But I'm not
You're
sure.
Good.
We do it with three outs, so I haven't seen any outs yet. Stoney, I would pay a lot of money to see a conversation between Stoney and Trevor Bauer. Whatever you think of Trevor Bauer, I think they both sort of have iconoclastic personalities. And I would love just to have Bauer have Stoney on his podcast for 30 minutes one day and just see where it went.
Yeah, you're describing sort of the baseball equivalent of the improv principle of yes and. Right. It's just sort of like if you're doing this, OK, let's do this and let's see where this goes. And is that OK? OK, yeah, this is OK. And I love that. It adds a personality and a creativity. And I think for you to phrase it the way you did, it makes people happy, and happy is more than OK right now. We'll be happy talking with Mike Petriello of MLB.com and StatCast, one of the smartest guys out there covering baseball, is going to join us next. It's Dan Bernstein and Jason Benetti hosting the Lawrence Holmes Show today on the
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Lawrence Holmes, noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station.
It's not my show, but I'm on that show. Same goes for Jason Benetti, as he and I are hosting the Lawrence Holmes Show today. And we have an opportunity to talk some baseball now with one of the smartest guys writing about it anywhere and talking about it. Mike Petriello of MLB.com joins us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Mike, how's it going?
Hey, guys. How are you?
We're good. Did you make anything of statistical significance of these 60 games? Because it's almost like we kind of agreed that we knew it didn't really mean anything, and yet we can't help ourselves still trying to divine some statistical meaning from it.
I think it sort of depends on what sort of stat you're looking at. Like, I found it really interesting that at the end of the season, standings more or less looked like what you would have expected, right? Like, there was some weirdness, obviously. You know, the Marlins got in, the Yankees sort of barely snuck in. But this was not a season that was turned upside down in terms of standings. And even if you were to look at the likely award winners, you know, look at the prospective AL MVP guys. Braves pretty good. Jose Ramirez is pretty good. You know, you don't have some backup catcher having like a really good 2-month streak. So I was pleasantly surprised by that. And even if you look at the underlying metrics, you know, who had the highest hard hit rate in baseball this year? Fernando Tatis Jr. He's really good. You know, so I do think you have to be wary, especially when you get into splits. Like, if you're splitting the season in half and saying, oh, how do you do against lefties? Yes, I'd be very concerned about that. But overall, I was sort of pleasantly surprised. We got a lot more signal than I thought we would.
Mike, what trend lines stand out to you in the playoffs so far?
Well, I think I'm almost, like, bored by talking about this particular one because it's just been, like, a daily thing. But, you know, teams that are hitting home runs in the postseason are winning baseball games. You know, the number is, like, 26-2 or something like that, I think, now, if you are out-homering your opponents. And I almost think that's sort of, like, self-explanatory. Home runs are good because they score runs and runs win baseball games. Like, we shouldn't have to point that out. And for me, I think it's just like a backlash to people saying, well, where's the bunts? Where's the small ball? You know, pitching wins in the playoffs. So that's been pretty fun to see just because it sort of goes into what we've always expected. You know, home runs are good and they are still good in October.
And one thing that's really nice is we're not talking about the ball. We're not wondering, oh, my goodness, look at that. It was off the fist. It was off the end of the bat. It was a broken bat. It was a bunt that went over the fence. That it does seem like there was some normalization of the baseball for whatever reason. And just the fact that it's not top of mind is really nice.
I think that's right, to a point, I guess. There were certainly, you know, the first couple of games in Texas, people were talking about how, you know, you could not hit a home run there. That's not ball related. I think that's a new ballpark thing. And certainly in some of the Oakland-Houston series in L.A., during the day, people are like, wow, I've never seen the ball fly out of the park like this. And I think people maybe underestimate, you know, the temperature in L.A. during the day. But I also got a kick out of some of that because some of the balls people were like, wow, I can't believe that ball went out. And I'd go and look up the numbers and it was like, yeah, that guy hit the ball like 112 miles an hour. Like, why are we surprised that ball left the park? He absolutely smashed it. But to your point, I think that's correct. And it's been nice to not have that be like an ever-present thing about every single home run.
Mike, I saw you arguing with somebody via subtweet earlier about the Rays and how interesting they are. What is your best argument to people who haven't seen the Rays or your best pieces of evidence to tell people that the Rays are interesting?
Oh, that was not a subtweet. I directly quote tweeted their article. I said, I know the Rays are not exactly the sexiest franchise in the sense of the Cubs or the Dodgers or the Cardinals, right? Like, of course. And they don't have Mookie Betts and they don't have, you know, these big name superstars, but they're a really fun team to watch. I mean, even just watching this ALCS series against Houston, the big story has been their defense. You know, if you like pitching and defense, this team has it. And I'm actually trying to dig into what they've done differently with their fielding right now. It's not just Kiermaier. You know, it's the infield. It's everybody being in the right spot, take away extra base hits and hard hit balls from the Astros. And then in terms of the pitching, if there is a type of pitcher that you like, they have that kind of pitcher. They have a lefty side armor. They have a righty side arm. They've got a high spin, you know, fireballing right-hander from over the top. They have Diego Castillo, who's hard to one side of the mound, throwing all sliders and bowling ball sinkers. Now, maybe you have to be a serious baseball fan to kind of appreciate some of that. But they have the elite starting pitchers, too. You know, Glasnow is amazing. Morton, Snell are all very good. So, you know, if you're looking for the guy who's going to be number one in jersey sales next year, if you're looking for the Aaron Judge and Mike Trout, they don't have that. And that's fair. But, man, this team is fun, and they're good, and they're always good.
Talking with Mike Petriello of MLB.com. You want to follow him on Twitter, you can at Mike_Petriello. How much of the Rays defense is having drafted good defenders and just deployed good defenders, and how much of it is developing them and or positioning them?
So that is exactly what I'm working on right now. I'm trying to figure this out. It's a complicated question. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is Kevin Kiermaier is an absolutely elite defensive outfielder, probably the single best defender in the game, or at least in that conversation. Right? And Manny Margot is pretty good, and Hunter Renfroe is pretty good. But otherwise, I don't look at this team and look around and say, these guys are all gold glovers. You know, I like Joey Wendell fine. You know, he's not the best defensive infielder in baseball. Willie Adames is fine. I wouldn't take him over, you know, Nick Ahmed or Andrelton Simmons. So I think it's a combination of a couple things. I think they're probably positioning guys pretty well. I also think, and I can't really back this up, that they've got all these guys who play a ton of different positions, right? Like, okay, Adames is the regular shortstop, but you've got Wendell playing all over the place. You've got a couple other infielders. I almost wonder if that makes them a little more comfortable with the shift or even like just non-shift different positioning. You know, if you are used to being on the right side of second base when you're normally a third baseman, does that help? Because there was a play last night that I found fascinating. It went in the books as a 4-6-3 double play, right? But the four and the six were both on the left side of second base. And the flip actually happened, I think, before the shortstop actually got to the bag. We've seen guys, other guys, kind of mess that up because it's not what you're used to. And again, I can't back this up. I'm just sort of talking out loud here. But it wouldn't surprise me if all that versatility and flexibility has helped them in that aspect as well.
Mike, who are the most underappreciated players remaining in the playoffs?
It's hard to get this far and not be super appreciated. The number one name I'm always going to go to is maybe baseball's most anonymous great reliever, and that's Nick Anderson. Nobody knows because his name is Nick Anderson to start with, and also because he didn't reach the big leagues until he was 29, I guess. And he spent part of last year with the Marlins, got traded to the Rays, and the man is absolutely dominant. He's not a closer. I think that's another reason. He's not piling up saves. He's pitching, you know, in big spots, third inning, fifth inning, seventh inning, whenever they need him. And his strikeout rate is something like 50% for his career. Yeah, he's not a name enough people know about. Again, he's a little older, not going to get 45 saves next year or any year. You know, but he's certainly the first one that stands out to me. I've also been interested in some of these Astros pitchers who aren't Zach Greinke, right? Fran Revaldez has been really good. Christian Javier I like a lot. There's always names, you know? If you look past the stars, if you know where to look, there's always talent if you get this far in the postseason.
What do you think is the larger picture effect on the accelerated development of young players, of guys? We used to use the term rushed, and I don't think we can really use that term anymore, because if you got a college pitcher in Garrett Crochet who's throwing 102, have him do it at the big league level. If you have someone like Randy Arozarena who has been languishing with another team that didn't like him, you know, bring him up. There are some guys who didn't play above A ball who all of a sudden can just play. And then, do you think there's a larger rethinking of developmental timetables now that we can measure things, now that development is more active than passive, that certain traits can be developed in different ways and things are measured and seen in different ways, that maybe there's a larger scale rethinking of major league readiness?
I think that's true. I also think that that trend started before this season. You know, you can see it over the last couple of years. I think I did a study like a year or two ago that a much larger share of wins above replacement came from players under 30 than had been in any previous year. You know, and it's not just the stars like Juan Soto, you know, Ronald Acuna, these really young guys, but it's also, you know, sort of role players as well. This year obviously is unique in the sense they didn't have minor leagues. You know, there were no options for a lot of these guys. I just saw tweeted now by Tyler Kepner at the New York Times, the Astros are going to start Luis Garcia today. He has made one start above Class A ball this year. Now he's starting in what is essentially a must-win game, and some of that's by necessity. Obviously, the Astros would not have chosen this to be their situation, but they have had a lot of injuries. Obviously, Verlander has been hurt. But I think to some extent you're right in that guys come up, you know, better prepared to succeed than ever before, and also it's easier to measure some of this stuff. Like Christian Javier that I mentioned before, I think he's a good example. You know, he does not have a fireballing, high-velocity fastball, and you can see in the minor leagues, he had a ton of strikeouts. And maybe in the past you'd say, well, you know, okay, he's striking out 18-year-olds at single A. I don't know how much that's going to play. Well, it was pretty clear. I remember from the very first game he threw this year that he had a fastball with a ton of rise to it, right? Like the rising fastball you hear about that misses bats. And that's held out to be true. You know, some of the stuff you can find out about right away, some of that stuff you don't even need to be in a big league game to find out about. You know, you can get that data in bullpens. And I think to your point, that helps identify a little bit more which guys are for real or have a real carrying skill and which guys were maybe just beating up on competition that they were too good for.
Mike, we use the phrase small sample size a lot about a lot of things. With that said, what should we make of Clayton Kershaw and his postseason foibles?
Well, I would point you to two starts ago where he carved up the Brewers and had, I think by game score, the second best start in the entire history of the Dodgers in the postseason. The Dodgers have had some pitchers. I think there is nothing he can do at this point, literally nothing. He could throw a perfect game in the seventh game of the World Series. It wouldn't matter. That is going to follow him around forever. Some of it is true. Like, he's had some stinkers. There's no doubt about it. And some of it, if you really go dig deep, is just he's been put in terrible positions. He has been asked to start on three days rest. A lot. Like, he's always compared to Madison Bumgarner, right? They have asked so much more of him than they asked of Bumgarner. There's been a ton of games where he has left with men on base because He was extended an inning further because they didn't trust their bullpen, and then the bullpen let those runs in, certainly. So the top line numbers, I think, are a little misleading. I'm not going to hand wave all this away. He's obviously had some bad games in the playoffs, for sure, but he's still Clayton Kershaw. You know, we saw him be dominant against the Brewers. We saw him be pretty good against the Padres. I have a hard time thinking anything that happens tonight is going to change his reputation at all. If he's terrible, well, then people will continue thinking that. And if he's great, people will still point to the times he wasn't. And I guess that's just how it works.
Mike, last thing for you. The frequency of games, the lack of travel, and the density of playoff games has made full rosters matter and full pitching staffs matter. I think it's really cool. I think it's great that you don't necessarily have one team with two dominant starters that can have them and just those two arms be the entire difference in a series. And it really does show how well-constructed full rosters can compete against each other. I found that really refreshing. And I know that ultimately, when and if things ever normalize, we're going to go back to long travel and time between games. But just as sort of an experiment, I think from just my fans' perspective, it's been fun to see all these guys you mentioned have to matter in a way they otherwise may not.
Yeah, I was looking forward to that, you know, from as soon as this was announced. And I mostly love it. Like in a best of seven, maybe I could argue for a day off after game four or something like that. But we had seen over the last couple of years that postseason baseball didn't really resemble regular season baseball. You were never using your fourth starter. There was, I think, 2 years ago in the NLCS, Brewers and Dodgers. I think the Brewers ended up using Corey Knebel 6 times in 7 games. Which, and by the way, he got hurt immediately after that. But I want postseason baseball to sort of look like regular season baseball. You know, I get it. You're not going to use the last man on your 40-man roster. That's fine. But if you have to use 3, 4, even 5 starters across a usual 6-month season to get here, I feel like you should have to do something like that in the postseason. It does reward depth. You know, it rewards more than just having the cream of the crop stars. But for the Dodgers and the Rays, they have depth. They have stars too, but they've got a ton of depth. And I've enjoyed that so far. I think you're right. I don't know if this is going to persist in the future, but I certainly would hope so, because I think this has been kind of a nice treat.
Mike, great stuff. We appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Bye, Michael.
That is Mike Petriello of MLB.com. Dan Bernstein with Jason Benetti here on the Lawrence Holmes Show. We got some football talk coming in the next hour, as we're going to talk with Mick Mixon, who is the radio voice of the Carolina Panthers. I'm happy to go in any direction you want, JB, because even though people know you as the voice of the White Sox, you also turn on the TV and see you calling all sorts of play-by-play for pretty much everything else. What's the most obscure sport you've called?
I have done play-by-play, as I was reminded by White Sox Director of Broadcasting Bob Grimm by text message about an hour ago. I have done play-by-play of the Ideal National Electricians Championships the last 2 years, and that is real.
Wait, what?
So every year, they do a championship for electricians, and ESPN2, one day every summer, turns into the Ocho for the dodgeball deal, and they do, like, you know, slippery stair climbing and assorted other wonky sports. And the one I've been asked to do 2 years in a row is the Electricians Championship.
All right, I want to hear more about this in just a second, but we need to take a brief timeout here on the Lawrence Holmes Show, hosted by Bernstein and Benetti on The Score. You have the Lawrence Holmes Show, but you don't have Lawrence Holmes today. You have Dan Bernstein and Jason Benetti. Tomorrow you'll have Cole Wright and me. As that he, in his position at Marquee Network, covering the Cubs and formerly at NFL Network, we thought it would be a fun time for him to pop in for a couple hours. But Jason Benetti is sitting in today, and because you're not here in studio, you didn't get to try Shane Reardon's duck fat potatoes. Oh, my God.
Really?
Oh, my God. Yeah. They're as good as you think.
I was asked on Twitter if I was jealous of them, and I will verbally say I am after seeing the picture of them on the tweet box.
Yeah, the only problem with the picture of them is that Shane's face is right behind them. I mean, if you sort of, if you let the food stand on its own and you don't need, like, the face of Bluto from Popeye behind it trying to make it look more appetizing. But that guy, he can turn out a duck fat potato, man, and aggressively seasoned too, salty and black peppery. And man, cooking in duck fat is really, you know, if you can do it, I guess you should, right?
Yeah, I thought you were talking about Shane, though. Salty and black peppery and seasoned as well, yeah.
Yeah, long, long season. Now, wait a sec. The electrician championships now. This sounds like the setup of the Steve Martin plumber joke, right? The lawn supervisor's out in a sprinkler maintenance job, and he starts working on a Finley sprinkler head with the Langstrom 7-inch gangly wrench. So, like, this is – are you doing it as a bit, or are you taking it serious? The whole point for you to take it seriously.
I figured that out about an hour and a half into the competition. I was in Kansas City with the Sox, and my agent called me and said, hey, ESPN's doing this Ocho thing, and they want you to do the Electricians Championship. We're taping in Chicago. Can you do it? And I was like, well, what's the prep like? And he said, well, let me check. And then I got on the phone with the people that were taping it, and they said, don't prep at all. And I said, what? How am I supposed to do that? And they said, well, you're going to be with a guy who's got the whole manual with him, and he's your expert, and you're just there to, like, I felt like Fred Willard from Best in Show is what was being described, right? Like, you know, a sad thing to say is in some countries these dogs are eaten, sort of thing. So I get there, and my partner is Scott Caron, who was Bob Vila's electrician on This Old House.
Well, it better be. I mean, you're not going to get some piker of an electrician if it's got that's going to be the top analyst. Come on.
Yeah, you don't want like the guy with burn marks all over his body, you know, to do the top competition. So we get in there, and the competition's already been taped, so we're voicing over it. It's in post production. And so we do a bunch of lines that are just straight up me and him. We're talking, and then we watch the competition and we call it. But as we're doing the lines, they said, okay, let's do one run through the script just straight ahead as the script is listed. And then let's do one where you guys kind of riff off one another. So we do it straight ahead. It's fine. It's good. And they're like, okay, well, let's have some fun with this next one. And so I do the script and I'm tossing to break. And I said, stay with us. Sparks will fly. And the guy in the booth with us, who is from the electricians championship, he's the liaison from the championship, goes, we can't use that. And I said, why? He goes, well, that sparks flying signals bad craftsmanship.
I'm with him.
And so we do it again. They say, okay, do it again, riff, whatever you want to say. And so I say, come back with us. Sparks won't fly. And he goes, oh, no, we can't use that.
Well,
and I
wait.
Said, why? He's like, well, you know, it's a little over the top. I said, then what am I here for? If neither of those land, what am I here for?
That reminds me of my internship at Channel 2 in the summer of 1989. When they were still using the most outdated technology, it was like horse and buggy stuff. Like they were still using IBM Selectric typewriters and actual carbon paper for scripts. And the teleprompter was literally the third copy of the carbon, scotch taped together and hand pulled underneath a vertical camera by a union electrician. Like, literally had to pull it so Bill Curtis and Walter Jacobson could read the copy as they sort of pull things. And during a newscast, all of a sudden, it started blowing off a fountain of sparks. Just arcing. And the poor guy, the guy jumps up, and this is and then they had to figure out, like, what to do, because if you didn't have it, like, right in front of Walter Jacobson, he'd kind of, you know, you could do the Ron Burgundy on you. So there somebody else is holding it up and trying to get everything, and it's flying everywhere. And it turns out that it was, like, that it was from 1966 or something like that. That actual camera. Like, what the hell is going on around here? You know, I'd been our student TV station at the time at Duke had stuff that was, like, brand new. And like, what are they doing? This is Channel 2? And, like, I guess they were proud of it for some reason.
That's when I first got to Syracuse, we were like the first class of freshmen who came in and got to edit tapes on like actual mini disc players or like cart machines, things like that we used to have in radio. The class before me told all the stories about editing audio with razor blades.
Yeah, we did that at, like, the score.
Yeah, that sounds unhealthy.
No, it was, you had tape, you had razor blades, and you had a grease pen to market. And I mean, I didn't know how to do any of it because I never trained in radio at all. I didn't know how to work anything. And it was all, I kind of lied about it and said that I did and kind of gave myself a crash course in all of it. But that's what people sort of knew how to do because that's what you trained in. Meanwhile, we've got some really cool White Sox news here that we should get to. Jose Abreu has been voted Sporting News MLB Player of the Year. So that's pretty cool. He joins Frank Thomas, who won it in 1993, and Early Wynn in 1959 as the only White Sox to be named MLB Player of the Year by Sporting News. And that's not all. You also get this, the Bamboo Steamer. You get Rick Hahn voted Sporting News MLB Executive of the Year, joining Roland Hemond in 1972 and Bill Veeck in 77 as the only White Sox executives to win the honor that was first awarded in 1936.
The Abreu part of that, I'm excited for Rick Hahn, but Rick Hahn and Kenny and they know what they built, right? Like they know what the future holds, or they believe they do in terms of depth in the organization. For Jose Abreu to get that, and you don't always get what you deserve in baseball. Everybody tells you, in order to get what you want to get out of a game, you prepare like you do, and things will just happen for you. And usually that's true in some way. But they hadn't in terms of winning for Jose Abreu. And you can see it. Sony and I have talked about it, I think, at length over the telecast, that there are some times where Jose feels alone in a lineup, and he starts swinging at balls out of the strike zone. And you can see in that, to me, that tells me how much he wants to win and drive in runs. And he has that sort of old school honor, chivalry that comes along with baseball. And to have him have the season he had and help the team be as good as it was in the regular season, failing those last 10 days, it's a beautiful thing to me, just for hard work purposes.
And I saw that Chris Kamka was actually looking at some of the interesting numbers that came out of this White Sox season. 60 runs driven in 60 games. That is, an RBI a game. Obviously, we know that RBIs are a function of your own batting and slugging and your teammates on base percentage. So it does speak well to the larger picture that you discuss. But that slash line for the 33-year-old Jose Abreu, 317 batting average, 370 on base percentage, and that massive 617 slugging percentage, 15 doubles, 19 home runs, 34 extra base hits, 21 multi-hit efforts in 60 games in his seventh season with the White Sox. And that number alone, the fact that it's been seven seasons already, time flies.
It really does. At some point mid-season, maybe it was the Cubs series and right thereafter, but you could see people really starting to shy away from throwing him strikes. I mean, it really, and I don't know why that happens so quickly in baseball. Maybe it's what tape is, or just managers looking and saying, okay, as they say, here's the guy that I don't want to beat me. But there was a point where it was like, he really, especially the last 10 days, he was really the guy you wanted up at the plate. And yes, he'd put up great numbers over the course of his six seasons prior, but there were moments where you thought, well, you know, he's not the guy that you necessarily want up in this moment because he's run cold. He didn't run cold ever in 60 games.
And there's a note here from Bill on Capitol Hill who says, regarding the Electricians Championship, frankly, Jason, I'm disappointed in the Electricians Championship. Too much emphasis on gut feel and not enough on the emerging metric of ohms over replacement wires.
I got to tell you, watching these championships and like the very intricate hand-eye coordination that you need to thread, and again, I did no prep, so I don't even know what these things are called, except I remember the term junction box.
Mm-hmm. That I know.
You run cables through things, and like what's fun about it is there's a team competition, and it's a pretty small space that you have to wire like a fake house. And part of it is you can't bump into one another. Like you have to work as a team to wire this house. And you watch the very intricate details that these guys and ladies use to put this thing together. It's actually quite fun to watch in sort of a balletic sense.
Hmm. Being the last one to finish.
Absolutely not. He has to be perfect if he's going to pull off this win.
The Aussie crowd at the very edge of the barrier and its seats. 10 seconds to go. Will Tom Maddock finish?
All right, he's got to screw that device in. That's the final thing he has to do.
3 seconds, two, one. And he just got finished right at zeros. Tom Maddox closes the deal at the very last moment. What drama in the very first international championship. And the light goes on.
The crowd goes wild.
Go ahead and sell it. Why not? Look, when you think about it, it's not that much dumber than a cooking show. And we love cooking shows, right? If it's like, is he going to finish the hollandaise fast enough? And is this a bad choice that he's pitting the olives this late and they're counting it down? What the hell's the difference?
No, there's no difference. I would sign up to do a different ridiculous championship on a yearly basis, because the things you can learn, and Scott's become a friend, this old house electrician, it's fantastic.
A friend that can come over and fix things for you? Because that's really all that matters there.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I'm angling toward. I can't believe I'm saying it publicly, and I hope he doesn't hear it. But, like, yeah, I want to know the guy for a long time, because I'm sure he's got a handyman in every location.
Yeah, I nearly electrocuted myself a week ago because one of the dials came off of my dryer, and then I tried to get I followed something on YouTube that says go buy this knob at Home Depot, and it's cheaper than actually getting the actual dryer knob, and it's called a D switch or something, and you pop it on there, and I pushed too hard, and it didn't quite fit, and the electrical assembly for the knob in the dryer fell into the dryer. So I got out a screwdriver and I took off the back of the dryer to find the thing and to put the thing back in. And there are wires on it that I didn't realize were live. And I was and completely shocked myself. And then I said, okay, well, that was weird. And then I did it again, not understanding that I could have unplugged the dryer so it wouldn't happen again. And my wife is going, what the hell is going on in there? And I said, nothing. I'm just electrocuting myself. And it ended up being fine. But now I have a pliers on there instead of a knob. So I need to talk to the guy.
Was it Terrence Dials that fell off?
No. I think he had a brother that played years ago. Derek Dials was
another
one.
Derek, Eastern Michigan,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, I think so. Wow. That's Jason Benetti, the man who knows everything about sports and everything about everything. Oh. Can we talk some Bears in a moment?
Yeah, sure.
All right, well, we're going to do that ahead of Mick Mixon, the voice of Carolina Panthers football, who's coming up at 1:20. It's a Lawrence Holmes show, but it's Benetti and Bernstein on the Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.